Okay, Erev Tov, I think we can get started. Hope everybody's doing well. All right, Parsha Ki Teitzei. As I'm sure most people are aware, Parsha Ki Teitzei has more mitzvot than any other Parsha in the Chumash. Of course, we don't have an agreed-upon count of mitzvot ever. We don't have a unified list of 613 mitzvot. But I think the count of the Rambam is that 74 of the 613 mitzvot are found in Parsha Ki Teitzei. It's chock full of mitzvot in all kinds of realms of life. What I want to do today a little bit is to talk about, we'll talk about some of the mitzvot, but I call it from narrative to law, and how sort of the narrative portions of the Torah and the legal portion of the Torah blend in together. Many of the laws of the Torah follow upon a narrative. That's probably best seen in Sefer Bamidbar, where you have, they're very much intertwined. Normally, the rest of the Chumash, Bereishit, of course, is all narrative. There's barely any law. The first half of Shemot is all narrative and a few laws, okay, Pesach mainly. And the last half of Shemot and basically all of Vayikra is just full of laws. And Bamidbar say is a mixed, and Dvarim is also mainly laws. But I want to discuss the relationship between some of these. So just to give an example, law and narrative, of course, are very much intertwined in the Chumash. The very simple, easy example, we begin that the whole story of Yetziat Mitzrayim is basically followed up by the law that we should not oppress a stranger. And we know how Yetziat Mitzrayim is the central story of the Chumash, more so than Mamad Har Sinai, right? All our mitzvot, we have very few mitzvot to relate because we were once at Mount Sinai. The Torah as a whole comes from Mount Sinai. But so many of the mitzvot are Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim, Zecher Yetziat Mitzrayim, to remember the Exodus. We don't have a specific mitzvah to remember our coming to Har Sinai. So the same way that the sort of the central theme of the Torah is the story of the Exodus, you could argue that the central mitzvah of the Torah is not to oppress a stranger. Why can you argue that's the central theme of the Torah? Anybody want to tell me why? Why that perhaps is the central mitzvah of the Torah? It's hard to know exactly what the central mitzvah of the Torah. Anybody want to guess? So that's because the Gemara says that this mitzvah appears 36 times, and then according to opinion, maybe 46 times. In other words, more than any other commandment in the Torah is the idea of to how to treat a stranger properly. That's just a very, very basic idea. We have the truth of the matter. We have the same idea and in the Talmud. I've mentioned before, there's a lot of sort of modern research on this, the intertwining between halacha and agadah. That the agadic passages in the Talmud are not just whatever they started, you know, they were tired. So instead of having a legal discussion, they told stories. The editing in the Gemara was done very precisely, and that the agada and the halacha go together. Just to give one example, we're learning Daf Yomi now in Ksuvos. So the laws, all the beautiful stories about God's special relationship to the land of Israel are in Masechet Ketuvot, which is, of course, the special relationship between a husband and a wife. I've mentioned many times the story of the destruction are in Masechet Gittin, divorce, where there's a separation between man and a woman. There's a separation between God and the Jewish people. To give a perhaps a less well-known example, but perhaps one of the most famous, you know, stories in the Talmud is the story of Rav Elazar, Tanur Shel Achnai, the oven that Rav Elazar insisted. It's a sort of such a crazy argument. In other words, Rav Elazar and Rav Yeshua are living 150 years after, not 150 years, they're living 60 years after the destruction of the temple. And they're having a debate about if an oven is taken apart and put back together, is that oven pure or not? And that's the famous story where Rav Elazar brings all these proofs from heaven, and you know, the water should flow backwards and the tree should move and the walls of the Beit Midrash should cave in and the heavenly voice should come out, and all those happen. And Rabbi Yeshua says, we don't really care, Torah lo b'shamayim hi. And then the Gemara says they excommunicated Rabbi Eliezer, and the end of that story is Rabban Gamliel dies, his brother-in-law. It's a very tragic story. All kinds of terrible things happen in the world. That's actually, it's in that Gemara where it says that not to oppress someone is mentioned 36 times in the Torah. So does anybody know where and what section of the Talmud this story takes place? Anybody have any idea What Masechet is that that Talmudic story? Do people know? I'm just curious. Not ready? You can put it in the chat box. Okay, so that's in Bava Metzia. Bava Metzia is like the I lose an object, I find it, property rights, all kinds of very technical things. The context of that chapter is what we call ona'ah, price fraud. I'm not allowed to charge you, overcharge for an object. That's the chapter, the fourth chapter of Bava Metzia talks about the laws of price fraud. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, not only is there ona'at mamon, price fraud, if you charge, let's say, more than a sixth of the market price, we have what's called onat varim. We call verbal abuse or needless mental anguish. And that's, you're not allowed to walk into store to price an object. You're not allowed to price an object if you have no intention to buy it. You're not allowed to remind the convert of his past ways, etc. The Mishnah says that's also ona'ah, that's oppression done with words. And it's in that context, it's in the middle of that discussion of the Gemara that the Talmud tells the story about Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. And clearly, I think, it seems pretty clear to me that what the Talmud is doing is telling us that this was a story where Onat Dvarim was violated, that they went too far in their excommunication of Rabbi Lezer and the anguish that they caused, and it caused terrible things. So that's just maybe an example people are not aware of, but always the narrative and the law always go hand in hand. And you always ask yourself, why is the story put next to law, or what's the context, etc. Now, this is especially true in the book of Dvarim, where the rabbis tell us that Darshin and Smuchin. We have this in the Torah, but especially in the book of Dvarim, you have to analyze why one thing follows the next. We could spend a lot of time, and I would have to do way more research than I've done, is why Parsha Ki Teitzeh, what is the connection between each one of the 74 mitzvot? Some are a little bit obvious. Some Rashi discusses, but others, it's very hard to figure out why does the Torah put this mitzvah next to that mitzvah. For example, one of the cute ones we have in the Parsha is on tzitzis, gedilim tasalacha, to put on fringes on your clothes is right next to the mitzvah of not wearing shatnes, not wearing wool and linen next to each other. And based on the juxtaposition of those two mitzvot, the Talmud actually says that you're allowed to wear tzitzis of shatnes. That if you own the only garment you have, let's say, a linen garment of four corners. So you have put on wool tzitzis, even though it's shatnes, because the two mitzvot are next to each other. You can wear tzitzis even if it's shatnes. So that's a halakhic derivation from the way two things are written next to each other. The rabbis are very much often will derive laws because how things are juxtaposed to each other. So I want to go through some of the stories or some of the ideas in Ki Teitzeh and see how they play off other stories in Tanakh. I'll start with one from last week. The end of last week's Parsha was the story of Egla Arufa. So the story of Egla Arufa is, of course, if you find a dead body in between two cities, and we do not know how the body got there. So the Torah has this very strange ritual that the elders of the city that are nearest by have to come and say, we didn't kill this person. And of course, the Talmud asks, does anybody in their right mind think the rabbis would kill somebody? I'm glad the Gemara thinks that's an impossibility. The Gemara says that cannot be. But what does it mean? It means the rabbis have to say the person didn't come to our city and we didn't escort him home. That's already a much harder idea. In other words, not that we didn't kill him, but we didn't provide food, we didn't provide housing, and he was wandering around in the street at night and he got killed. So it's indirectly, the rabbis are indirectly possible. I remember at the a bar mitzvah of a cousin of mine, my uncle spoke, and my uncle said, what if the rabbis can't say such a thing? In other words, the Torah says, we didn't kill him. So we didn't kill him means, of course they didn't kill him. What it means is we provided him with all the necessities, so he had no need to be alone. He wasn't wandering around. We were not even indirectly responsible. Sometimes rabbis can't really say that. Sometimes they are indirectly responsible. This is a very high level of leadership, and this is what the Torah demands of the leaders. If people get killed, it's the fault of the leaders. They've got to be careful. Just like the person who kills accidentally, he stays in the Aron Mikvah until the Kohen Gadol dies. What does the high priest have to do? What's the connection between the Kohen Gadol dying and the person leaving? The leaders create a climate. You know, people speed too fast on the highway and they get into accidents and things happen. It's because of a certain culture. In certain countries, certain things are the norm. And in other countries, you know, people drive more following the law. So that's the responsibility of the leaders. Of course, they have nothing to do with it directly. So that's the same idea. Now, it's all very nice. So in an article, I've mentioned this article, I think, on other occasions, Rabbi Benjamin Blech says, the Egla Arufa, what biblical story is this law playing off? This law of Egla Arufa, that you have to take a calf and you have to slaughter the calf and say, we didn't kill, we are not responsible for the death of this person, is a response to a particular story in the Bible. And what's that story?
Yosef and his brothers.
Yosef and his brothers. That's very interesting. Why do you say that?
Because they have to accept responsibility.
So I would say the Yosef and the brothers is represented in another law. The law that on every single yontif, you have to bring a Seir Izim for a sin offering. We have to bring a goat every holiday. Why? Because the brothers dip.
Because they dip the blood.
In a Seir Izim. And as a reminder, Yosef, why do we go to Egypt, right? What are all the holidays? I said, Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim. Every holiday we say in Kiddush, Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim. Why do we end up in Egypt? Because the brothers sold Joseph to Egypt. So the Torah takes the narrative of Joseph, that they dipped his coat in a Seir Izim, in a goat, and that becomes the law that on every a sin offering, right? All the other korbanot are not sin offerings. On Shabbat, we don't bring a sin offering. That's why, by the way, if you ever wonder, you know, on Shabbat, when Yom Tov falls on Shabbat, you add the words ba'ahava, you know, in every machzor, they put it in brackets. We say, or what I'm doing the Kiddush to, but you know what I mean, the ahava. And the reason we say ahava is because there's no sin offering on Shabbat. Yom Tov, there's a diminution of our joy because we have to remind yourself of the terrible story of Yosef, and therefore every Yom Tov requires a Seir Izim. I don't know how many people think of that when they read Musaf every Yom Tov, you know. When they read it, we're going to read it on Rosh Hashanah too. We're going to read the same Musaf, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. They also bring a Seir Izim. But now it should...
Yaakov also used an Izim to trick his father.
That's correct. The Izim. That's also true. It's also a reminder of that. Absolutely. Yaakov tricking his father. Excellent. Right, but now new Egla Rufa. So what?
Okay, the Akedah.
I'm sorry.
The Akedah.
The Akedah. Oh, that's interesting. Why the Akedah?
Because we have a substitution of a ram for Yitzchak.
Right. So how does that tie to an Egla Arufa?
Well, so the Egla Arufa is sort of, you know. For this dead person, what we're saying is we don't understand this, where this dead person came from, and we're sacrificing. So we don't want to sacrifice Yitzchak. We're sacrificing something in Yitzchak's place.
Who would be sacrificed by the Egla Arufa? We don't know who killed this person. So, you know, some people explain that the process of Egla Arufa is to make a big hullabaloo, and some witness will come forward who saw what happened. In other words, why do we have this whole procedure, but we don't know who we're substituting for because we don't know who the person that was killed. But okay, that's an interesting idea. But where does the eagle appear in Chumash?
The sin of
very
the
famous
calf.
Story. We all know the story.
The sin of the golden calf,
the chet eagle. Now the chet eagle. That's what Yom Kippur is all about. Forgiveness for chet eagle. What is the connection between chet eagle and Egla Arufa? So in a brilliant piece, and I'm going to share my screen just to show you the verse, and you'll see the connection to Egla Arufa. This is the Chet Egel, which we read about. Why is my screen very funny? Okay.
Shay Oref?
No, I mean, maybe. Okay, so Moshe comes down from Mount Sinai. Bayar Moshe et Ha'am. Moshe sees what's going on. Or in English, they're out of control. The people were out of control since Aaron had let them go out of control. Okay, good. And then he says, so Moshe says, Mila Shem Eloi, and the Bnei Levi come to Moshe. And then God says, or Moshe says that God told him, it's not like directly from God, Komar Shem Elohei Israel. It's interesting. There's a missing idea here that God told Moshe. Moshe just said, there's like an interruption, but the verse doesn't show it. It sounds like it's immediate. Moshe said, come to me, And then Moshe says, this is what God told me to do. God told me to tell you, go kill everybody. This is not very nice. A civil war here. We're going to kill all the Jews who participate. I mean, after idolatry, 40 days after Mount Sinai. I mean, after all that God had done, they're building a golden calf. We're going to kill them, Avodah Zarah. I mean, I'm not saying that's what it says in the Torah. V'ishet Re'ehu, kill your friend. Did it. V'ishet Krovo, his relative. And the B'nai Levi did it. The B'nai Levi did it. That's their special, you know, status by Yifol. And you have to remember, Levi already wiped out the city of Shechem. Levi has this sort of character trait in him of anger and burning anger that later gets channeled into teaching Torah. Right, that's the transformation of Levi. So, and how many people? They killed 3,000 people. It's pretty good. Only 3,000 people worshiped the Chet Egel. And then the next day, Vayimi Macharat. On the next day, Moshe said, "You sinned a great sin, and now I'm going to go up to God. Maybe Ulayecha Pravat Chatatcha. Maybe God will forgive you." What do you mean? Who sinned a great sin? What great sin? All the people who sinned the great sin are dead. They're all dead. The Torah just told them they were all killed, right? So Rabbi Blech points out that this is what Yom Kippur is all about. This is the passive. The people didn't do anything. It's the passive sin. It's the elders who were standing by while the Chet Egel was going on, and they how could they let 3,000 people do it? So the real sin of Chet Egel is not the people who worship the golden calf. What Moshe prays for 80 days at Mount Sinai to forgive the Jewish people, that's not to forgive the people who worship the golden calf. That's to forgive the people who did nothing while the golden calf was being worshipped. So that's exactly what the Egla Aruf is. The rabbis did nothing while they let this guy get killed. So that's a beautiful insight that I mentioned this, but I don't remember when I've mentioned it before here. And he mentions that in the context of why he became a rabbi. That's his argument. He said when he was in yeshiva, they tried to convince him not to become a rabbi, and he became a rabbi because he wanted to, you know, get involved. You can't just let assimilation happen. This is the Chet Egel. Anyways, so there you have a very beautiful idea that we can, you know, think about on Yom Kippur, about the connection between a story that takes place 40 years earlier, so to speak, and this law that's written, like, you know, most of the Chumash away. You know, Chet Egel's in the first half of the Chumash. So that's just one idea. Okay, let's go Ki Teitzei. So I'll mention an idea that I thought of. You can tell me if you think it's a crazy idea, but because I haven't seen it anywhere else. So I made this one up, so I don't know if it was any water. Parsha Ki Teitzei, as it says, has more mitzvot than any other parsha in the Torah. 74 mitzvot, let's say. Now, Parsha Ki Teitzei is related, at least linguistically, to what other parsha in the Torah? What parsha does Ki Teitzei linguistically remind you of? Vayetzei. Vayetzei Ki Teitzei, right? Vayetzei. Now, Vayetzei is back in Bereshit. Okay, fine. It has a similar name. Great. But I think there's more to it than that. What's Parsha? Parsha Vayetze is the story of the great narrative of the founding of the Jewish people. What happens in Parsha Vayetze? Yaakov Avinu runs away from Esav. He comes to his uncle's house. He works hard. And we read about the birth of 12 of his children, 11 sons and one daughter, Dinah. Binyamin is born the next week in Vayishtach. Vayetze is the physical birth of the formation of the Jewish people. What's Ki Teitzei? Ki Teitzei is the spiritual heights of the Jewish people, the mitzvot. It's the parsha with more mitzvot than any other in the Chumash. So you've got this sort of combination, physical and the spiritual. Also, what happens in Vayetze? Vayetze opens up. Yaakov Avinu is running away from Esav. Esav is going to come and kill him. There's going to be a war, right? He's afraid. He prepares the camp, right? The next week, he prepares the camp for war with Esav. What's Ki Teitzei? Ki Teitzei l'milchama, oivecha, when you go out to war. In other words, Vayetze was the individual war that Yaakov had a fight facing the world at large for the first time. He'd been living at home. Now he's going to be out on his own, out in the open, out all vulnerable. And Ki Teitzei is now the Jewish people are going to be vulnerable. They have to go out to the world and they have to fight in the battle. So I don't know. I don't know if that makes any, you know, but I just thought that was sort of, you could perhaps read Vayetze and Ki Teitzei as sort of flip sides of the same coin. One focusing on the foundation narrative of the Jewish people, one founding the parsha that has more mitzvot than any other, and the idea of going out into the world, Vayetzi, the individual Yaakov, and Kiteitse, La Milchama, Olevecha, on the Jewish people. And of course, the parsha ends with Amalek. The parsha begins with war, and the parsha ends with war. It's very interesting, because last week's parsha also had war. In other words, they could have put, you know, when the rabbis divided the parsha, I mean, this, you know, but the end of Shatim is who doesn't go to war, right? It sort of flows with Kitetze, but we separate it out into two various parshiot. Okay, that's one idea. Then there's another idea, I think this is pretty clear in the Chumash. The next parsha after Kitetze l'melchama, going out to war, is Kitiena l'ish tei nashim, when a man has two women. Achad avav, achad snuaz, is well known that polygamy was allowed till the 11th century. It's not so long ago. Most of Jewish history, polygamy was allowed. We don't know. We're not aware, to the best of my knowledge, there's not one Talmudic rabbi who we know of who had more than one wife. In other words, in the Bible, yeah, the Bible, a lot of people have more than one wife. And all the kings, and Shlomo Melech, and David Melech, everybody have more than one wife. But when you get to Rabbinic Judaism, when you get already the foundations of Judaism, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, the people whose wives we know of, Rav Nachman, there's, you know, Yalta, Bruria, Rachel, there are various women we know, but there was no second wife, you know, here. Now, why was there no second wife? Because the Torah really thinks having two wives is a really, really bad idea. It's a really bad idea. And how do we know it's a bad idea? So Rashi tells you it's a bad idea, because the parsha after this is a ben sorer umoreh, a rebellious child. Why are they connected? That's right. What's the connection? Well, you know what? You've got a wife you love and a wife you hate. That's how the Torah says. You love one and you hate the other. You're going to end up with children who are, we're not talking about going off the derech, that they are mechalel Shabbos. That's not something. They're thieves and, like, worse, drunk, abusers, the terrible things, ben sorer umoreh. And, so that's the linkage there. But, and also the Torah says, in other words, it's not if you have a wife, if you have two wives, one who you like and one who you don't like. The word ki has many meanings. It means when. It means when you have two wives, there will be one who you like and one who you don't like. It's not if you have been two wives and you don't like them equally. No. When you have two wives, achad ovav, achad snuva, one you will like better, one you like better. It's impossible, not humanly possible, to have one more than the other. Now, who had two wives who he liked and he didn't?
The language is exactly like Rachel and Leah.
Of course.
He said, ki snuva anokhi.
Bayar Hashem ki snuva Leah. Why did Leah have children? All the other imahot were barren. And the Talmud says, not in the Talmud, it says in the Torah, Vayar Hashem kishnua Leah, God saw that Leah was hated. Vayiftachet rachma, and he opened her womb. So, but it's so obvious when you think about it. I don't know how many people have thought about this story. To me, this is just so, it's like, it strikes you in like, you can't miss it. This is the Torah's commentary on Yaakov and Leah and Rachel. And it was a disaster. That's why Yosef went down to Egypt. And that's why we have a sin offering on Yontif. We're still suffering from that terrible thing. In other words, in a certain sense, Yaakov violated this law, so to speak. Yes, the Torah allowed polygamy. The Torah, same thing, the beginning of the parsha. You think the Torah likes you go out to war. We didn't even discuss the actual law, Kitetze. You find a woman, you want to rape this woman, you know, but the Torah, don't rape her, you know, so you'll shave her head. You'll do all these other things. That's the Dibra Torah connected Lashon Hara. The Torah connected Yetzer Hara. The Torah speaks to our evil inclination. The Torah sometimes, like a great educator, sometimes a parent, a teacher has to let people do things that they shouldn't do, because if they don't let A, they're going to do way worse. So that's this example here. So it's the same thing. The Torah allowed polygamy, and in the world where women were whatever, you know, they couldn't fend for themselves. So whatever, we don't know why. We don't know why, but in the way we know it's a man's world. It still is, I guess, I say, unfortunately, whatever. We would have made great, great strides, but we know there's still discrimination. So the Torah, for whatever reason, maybe was to protect the woman, because a woman on her own who was not married would be lost, and more men died because men went to war, men hunted. In the ancient world, they're always, even today, we know there are more women, they're more single. Everybody knows in the single crisis, there are more girls out there than boys. There's always more women, especially when men are fighting, hunting and going to war. So there were excess women, so to speak. That's not a nice term. I didn't mean it the way it came out, but I hope you understand what I meant. So by allowing a man to marry more than one wife, you could argue it was done for the benefit of the woman. Whatever it was, it's not a good thing. Maybe it's allowed and under the circumstances is better than nothing. But the Torah tells you, they don't like this. By using the language of Yaakov, of the cases we know, and the truth of the matter, Avram and Sarah didn't fare much better with Hagar. You know, it was Sarah's idea for Avram to marry Hagar, but it didn't work. Hagar, as Sarah said, throw her out of the house. It just cannot work. Polygamy was allowed. It got formally banned, as we know, by Rabbeinu Gershon in the 11th century, maybe the end of the 10th century, beginning of the 11th century. I think Rabbeinu Gershon died in 1028, I believe. So he was the one who formally banned it, but it was really not done. It just, he put a cherem, an excommunication.
That was only for Ashkenazim. That wasn't for Sfardim.
Correct. That is correct. The Sfardim did not influence that. So again, I don't want to give a whole shear on this idea, but what this historians and the scholars point out, first of all, a lot of it is the Christian and the Islamic influence. The Jews of Ashkenaz lived under Christianity. Christianity views even one wife as not such a great idea. The priest cannot marry. Having one wife is a concession to human weakness, is the brat Torah, so to speak, neged yetzer hara. So the idea of polygamy in a Christian society was basically a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. So in Sephardic lands, the Sephardim lived under Muslims. Muslims had more than one wife. So there is definitely the cultural influence that had an impact on this. And there's also the idea that it was done, as people say, because men were going on trips and they were, you know, the trip then took you 3 years. You know, you went back and forth. A year. A short trip is 6 months. So the men would take another woman, you know, like, my wife at home, I'm not going to see her for 8 months. So they would pick up another woman on the way. Very not nice. So Rabbeinu Gershon wanted to excommunicate a Jew who would do such a thing. But I don't know how common. I mean, we know in Israel, a Jews from Yemen, there were people who had more than one wife. Yeah, but we know that's a totally different cultural mindset, I think, than anybody here who is online with us. And you're right, it was technically allowed, but I don't know if it worked out. Great, but I don't think it worked out so often. But anyways, yes, you're right. The technical prohibition, although you should know today in the state of Israel, it is prohibited for everybody. Even Sephardim are not allowed to wear. The rabbinate prohibited. They grandfathered it. If you came in 1948, you came from Yemen with three wives, they didn't make you divorce the later two of them. By the way, you should know that's the Ramban has a scary, I don't know what to call it, a scary comment. The Ramban says, you know, but Yaakov married Rachel and Leah. You're not allowed to marry two sisters. That's a law in the Torah. You can't marry, even after one, you know, you can't marry two sisters. You can't divorce one sister and marry the other. Only if one sister dies, then you can marry the other. But so they said, no, but we have some kind of a tradition. Yaakov Avinu kept the Torah before it was given, whatever that means. So the Ramban said that only applied in the land of Israel. They didn't keep any Torah outside of Israel, but they went to Israel. So when they're going back to Israel, Yaakov Avinu couldn't be married to two sisters because that would be against the Torah. No, he married Rachel later than Leah. So Rachel had to die so he could be with Leah. No, it's a very, I don't know what to make of that comment, but that is a comment of the Ramban that he makes on that idea. But Israel did grandfather it in, but I don't know if there's anybody alive anymore who has more than one wife legally. I just find it interesting as an aside, and I know this is a dangerous thing to say, but you know, our views of marriage, when I say ours, I mean our society's views of marriage have totally changed. You know, if you would have told somebody 25 years ago, two men could marry each other, two women could marry each other, they think you're out of your mind, you know, and today it's the norm, it's accepted, and even in, you know, even on the fringes of Orthodoxy, people are talking about maybe we can have some ceremony for two men who want to marry each other. I'm not making any comments on that now. But what's fascinating is polygamy is still totally illegal. You can go to jail in Canada for a polygamous marriage. I really don't understand why. I don't understand why if two consenting adults want, two men want to marry, because they're tight, so the society lets them. So if five people want to get married, one man and one woman, why does society stop? I don't know. If somebody has an explanation, can somebody explain to me why our society bans polygamy while it permits all kinds of other forms of marriage? I just don't understand that from a consistency point of view. But if you want to ignore that comment, feel free to ignore that. Okay, let's go on with a few other ideas in the Parsha. So let's talk about Amalek a little bit, because that's the end of the Parsha. And that's, of course, I'm not going to talk about the moral quandary of wiping out Amalek. That's all other shir. It is a moral quandary, which, you know, whatever, however you want to address that. But what's interesting, again, is the story of Amalek takes place in B'Shalach, took place when we left Egypt. But the law to harm Amalek takes place in this week's Parsha. When we read Parsha Zachor, we don't read in B'Shalach, where it happened. We read about what happened 40 years later. Now, there's another event, and then we'll come back to Amalek. There's another event that also happened 40 years earlier, and the Torah prohibits in this Parsha, prohibits or mentions in this Parsha, and that's the Lashon Hara of Miriam. Miriam spoke Lashon Hara against Moshe way back, you know, in the beginning. It's in Balocha, but it's in their first year. And in this week's Parsha, there's a mitzvah. It's really a very tragic mitzvah. Zachor et asher asah Hashem leMiriam. You have to remember what God did. Hishamer b'neged tzarat. It's the context. If you have a tzarat, whatever tzarat is, some lesion on your skin, you're not allowed to chop it off. And then in that same, the next pasuk, Zachor asher asah Hashem lekein leMiriam. Remember what God did to Miriam. Miriam got tzarat for talking Lashon Hara on Moshe v'derech betzeichem Mitzrayim when you left Egypt. So this is a very tragic thing. I may mention before Rav Lichtenstein, when one of the press conferences he used to run, you know, Rav Lichtenstein would sit around and you could ask him any question you want. So somebody once asked him, are there any tragic figures in Tanakh? As we're talking to an English literature, a PhD from Harvard, Rav Lichtenstein, of course, had. So, you know, tragedy, literature, et cetera. So he said, of course, Miriam. Miriam was a tragic figure because without Miriam, there would be no Jewish people. She was the one who saved Moshe. She was the heroine of the whole story, etc. And yet the legacy of Miriam is to remember that she spoke Lashon Hara on Moshe. It's a very tragic, in a way unfair to Miriam, but that's what the Torah says. There's Zachor, and it's listed in the six memories, the six things we have to remember every day. Mamar Har Sinai and Shabbos and the Man. There's some things we have to remember. It's printed in the back of some Sidurim. So you have to remember what about Miriam, that Miriam spoke Lashon Hara. So here too, you have the Torah waits 40 years to put the prohibition in. What's interesting is you have, I was thinking, you know, time. See, we have another thing. The Torah has in this week's Parsha, you cannot marry an Ammoni and a Moabite. How come you can't now marry an Ammoni and a Moabite? Lo tavo Ammoni v'Moabi v'kal Hashem. Why not?
Lo kidmu etchem v'lechem uv'mayim.
Lo kidmu etchem
v'lechem sechar alechem et Bilam.
Yeah, so who cares about Bilam, right? You know that thing, right? Because they didn't give you water. Listen, Ammon and Moab are Lot. That's Lot's, you know, children. Lot, and Abraham saves Lot. They wouldn't be around without Abraham. And yet they said, we're not going to bother you. Just give us water. And they said no. So that's a terrible thing. So why does the Torah add Asher Sachar Alechem at Bilam Ben Bor? And they also hired Bilam Ben Bor, the Moab, Balak, Mel of Moab, hired Bilam to curse the Jewish people. It's very nice. Why do we need a second reason? So I went through a cute explanation, but I think there's something to it. You know, people have all kinds of excuses for why they do certain things. The way you know if their excuse is valid, you have to look what else they do. What else? I don't have any money. I can't give any charity. And then the guy goes, takes 10 people for Pesach to Florida, spends $100,000. So what do you mean? Can't give $5,000 to his local school, but he can go $100,000 to Florida. You can look at look at what else the person does and see, maybe it's true. Maybe he can't give $5,000. But if you can go $100,000 to Florida for Pesach, you can give $5,000. So it's the same thing. Knew the Jewish people, there are 2 million people watching in the desert. You're in the desert. Water is at a premium in the desert. They're going to give all the water to the Jewish people. They can't afford it. They're not such a rich country. But they had all the money in the world to pay for Bilam. They have Malo Bayit, the biggest houses you want. I think it's an interesting explanation that the problem with Bilam, the problem with Moab is not just that they weren't nice to us. They wouldn't spend money on the Jewish people. They wouldn't spend money for the Jewish people, but they spent Bilam. The vaults were open. Anyway, but what's interesting is what about an Egyptian? How long is the prohibition to marry Ammoni and Moabi people?
Forever.
We don't know who they are anymore. Whatever. That's maybe a trick of the rabbis. We don't know who they are. Very nice. But how long can't you marry an Egyptian for?
Three generations.
That's very interesting. Why the difference? Egypt enslaved us.
They first took us in.
Right. They took us in. They have extra chesed. Right. They took us in. So whatever it is, sometimes time heals big wounds. You know, it's true. They took us in. The Germans also took us in, but we don't remember Germany because they once took us in. We talk about Germany as on the Nazis. We don't, there are certain things you do. So they took us in. Very, very nice. That was their grandparents, but they killed us. But certain times, certain things time can heal. Even now, the relationship between Israel and Germany is very, very strong. I think Israel, when I was in Germany, we went on our Jewish history trip a number of years ago to Germany. We were there the same weekend. The consul general from Germany in Boston invited like 15 Boston rabbis, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform rabbis to come to Germany on a trip, see Jewish life. And they were staying in the same hotel we were. And I remember the German consul general in America, we were schmoozing with him, and he told us that Germany is Israel's best friend in Europe. We were the ones who sold Israel nuclear-powered submarines, and he was saying all the wonderful things that Germany has done for Israel. It was just very interesting. And we know Germany has taken their responsibility to the Holocaust much more seriously, etc. But so certain things time can heal and certain things time can't heal. And Amalek, the Torah didn't allow time to heal. With Amalek, 40 years later, no. Amalek, terrorism, attacking the women, the children for no reason, whatever it is, whatever the terribleness of Amalek is, Amalek doesn't go away. The Egyptians, yeah, they enslaved us and they killed us and they did all kinds of terrible things to us, but we can move on. It's a very interesting thing. I just find the parallels are a little bit striking about how the Egyptian prohibition is only three generations, and Ammon and Moab was a much long. It's an indefinite prohibition. Okay. Then
I remember reading Rabbi Sachs a couple of weeks ago when he explained asking the women, the Jewish women, asking their Egyptian neighbors for the gold and the silver and stuff like that. He said that was the reason why we were able to forgive them, because in a sense they had to somewhat pay for it.
The Chaim Leibowitz quotes the commentary of Shaddal, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's in her book, you know, on studies in Shmuel, where the last thing we had to do, as you say, it was to ask the Egyptians for gold and silver in order that we should have good memories of Egypt. What's the last thing Egypt did for us? They gave us gold. And so that's the same idea. So the Torah wanted us to have a good memory of Egypt, right? On the other hand, there's a prohibition to return to Egypt. Three times the Torah mentions the prohibition. And you know, they say they found manuscripts. How could the Rambam live in Egypt? How could a Jewish community live in Egypt? You're not allowed to go back to Egypt. So it seems like the Torah distinguishes between Egypt as a country and the Egyptian people. You're not allowed to go back because Egypt as a country, although that's where we formed, I would have argued the exact opposite. I would have argued the Egyptian people were mean to us, whatever, but Egypt, that's where we became a nation. That's the place we developed. But the Torah says, don't go back to the country, Egypt. the people of Egypt, you can marry them. They can be, they can, I mean, they convert, whatever, they become part of you. They're not outside of the pale. So I find that just very interesting, where Ammon and Moab are outside of the pale, but you can't kill them. You can't hurt Ammon and Moab. Altikar ba milchama. You're not allowed to go to war with them. You're not allowed to hurt them. So we have different levels of outsiders, so to speak. And Amalek is the most extreme. Amalek, we have to wipe out, whatever, like I said, without getting into all the moral quandaries. But you see different approaches. Some we're going to accept you. Ammon and Moab, of course, then we accepted the woman of Ammon and Moab, Ruth, but that's okay. And the Ev Mitzrayim, Ammon and Moab and Amalek. Now, Amalek, of course, is the worst, and that's how the parsha ends. But I want to point out something which maybe I've said before, but it's worth saying all the time. It's actually pretty scary, but it goes with my, you know, background as an accountant. Jewish people always ask, I know it sounds unfair, whenever bad things happen, right? Why was the temple destroyed? Sinat Chinam, right? What do we want the temple destroyed? Because the Romans were terrible people. And the Romans, they did terrible things, and they wanted, they wouldn't let us go. Why do we always do that? So again, whenever the rabbis say, the rabbis are not telling us why something happened. They don't know who that, and they weren't, and the whys are geopolitical answers. The rabbis are saying, as Rav Soloveitchik always said, they're not asking lama, it's lama. Not why, but for what purpose. They're saying, what can we learn from the fact that the temple was destroyed? And what we can learn is we have to get along better as a people. That otherwise that weakens us as a society. And when the rabbis have 10 different reasons for something in a lot of these questions, because the rabbis are not answering what happened. The rabbis are saying, what message can we learn from our generation for what happened? New, in every generation, there's a different message you have to learn, or in every country, in every city, there's a different message you have to learn. So when the rabbis say, like, why did Amalek? Amalek is evil and terrible. Nonetheless, the rabbis say, why did Amalek come? What did we do wrong? It sounds like blame the victim, you know. I don't think that's what's going on here. I really don't. And I hope this is not, I don't think this is apologetics. I don't think that's what the rabbis meant at all. The rabbis will always ask, why did this sin happen? Why did that? Why did this punishment happen because of this sin, that sin? The rabbis are not saying that there's a direct link. They're not prophets. They don't know. The rabbis are saying, lema, what can we learn? Because if you don't learn anything, then that's really sad. So the rabbis have this by Amalek too. What is it that the Jewish people did that caused Amalek to attack? Now, clearly it's not true historically. It can't be true historically, but the rabbis see a connection. Anybody want to tell me what the connection is? Why do the rabbis say we get burdened with an Amalek attack? Why are there the Amaleks of the world after us?
They attack the hindmost people.
I understand. I understand. But why? What? Now I'm flipping the question. Don't look at Amalek, look at us.
Because the rabbis say
we Jewish people did something wrong, and quote unquote, as a punishment, as some reflection of what we did wrong, Amalek comes to attack us.
Because we doubted God.
We doubted God. So that's what it says. Achor d'asher solach Amalek. What does it say? Vata yeh b'yageya. The Lo Yarei Elohim. So the question is, who's Lo Yarei Elohim going on? Amalek or the Jewish people? So you want to argue, right, it's going on, the Jewish people didn't fear God. Could be, but not necessarily. Like I said, Lo Yarei Elohim may have been on God, may have been on the Jewish people. And that may be a little bit true. But what particular sin? What was it? What sin did we do that demonstrated that we don't fear God? So I'm going to show you, it's in Rashi in this week's Parsha.
I think sometimes they say not seeing the hand of God, noticing, thinking everything.
You're all too religious. Don't be so religious. Think of something more mundane. You're thinking, they didn't keep kosher, they didn't keep Shabbos, none of that stuff. Get into the real important stuff. Remember, I started this year by telling you that the most important story in the Bible is leaving Egypt. That's the story of the Bible. And the most important mitzvah in the Bible is to be nice to strangers, don't oppress strangers. So think in ethics, think always ethics. So what is it? So let me share. I'll share my screen. And what do I have to tell you? I'll let Rashi tell you. So Rashi says, let's see where we're going here. Why don't I see it here? Here we go. Okay. Zachor de Sher Salacha Amalek, but Derek Mitzvah Mitzvah. Remember what Amalek did. So remember I said, especially in the book of Romans, we have to look juxtaposition. What story or what law is juxtaposed right before Amalek? So the Torah says like this. Lo yelcha bikischa even va'aven gdolakta. You can't have two stones, two weights, big and small. Lo yevevecha eifa veifa gdola v'knas. Two measures in your house. Even shleima b'tzedek. Complete stone. Even shleima b'tzedek yelach l'man yerichun yamim elamash. So you have long life. In other words, when you sell a pound of meat, you can't put it on a scale for 15 and a half ounces. Right? You've got to have honest weights. This is the parsha of honest weights. And not having honest weights is a toiva. That's a pretty strong word. That's have to keep that in mind. You know, people always like to talk. This is toiva. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik pointed out, they want to say, let's say, by homosexuality, where the Torah also uses this expression. The Torah doesn't say the people who engage in homosexuality are doing toivat. They said the action is a toiva. Here, kol osa'ela, the people who have dishonest ways, they are abominable. You know, they, for everyone who does it, they do that in English, is abhorrent to God. It's not the action is abhorrent to God. The person is abhorrent to God. So then it says, remember what Amalek. So what does Rashi say? Can you see it on my screen? I'm blocked off because of the way, I don't know if you can see. Zachor here, I'll say, do it in Hebrew. Im shakarta b'mitot v'mishkalot havido eg migurei ha'oyev. If you lied in measurements and weights, you better be worried about the lion, Amalek, attacking you. Mosne mirma tovat Hashem. You have false weights. That's falsifying God. That means you don't believe in God. God says, give a pound of meat for a pound of meat. That's what it means not to believe in God, not to follow God. Uchtiv adre bazadon ve'yavo kalon. It's going to be really, really terrible. So that's what, put it in English for, you know, if you use false weights, then you must apprehend the provocation of the enemy. So right, I didn't make this up. This is what Rashi says. Amalek is a reaction to dishonesty in business. Now, where does Rashi get it from? This is also earlier in the Chumash. So this, why don't I see this now? How do I do this? Oh, I know why. Okay. So let's go here. This is based on an earlier pasuk in Vayikra. In Parsha Kedoshim, chapter 19. Remember, chapter 19, I said ki teitze, it is the most mitzvot. There are a few, but Rashi says that chapter 19 in Kedoshim is the Parsha with Rov Gufei Torah Tluim, but the majority of the essence of Torah is dependent on chapter 19. Love your neighbors yourself, don't take revenge, don't gossip, etc. So here, the end of the Parsha, Moznait Tzedek, it's the same idea. Have honest weights, honest balance, honest weights, honest sefa. Torah's pretty likes honest. Tzedek, 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 Tzedek. Four times in one verse, right? Lota, it's pretty, Torah thinks it's important. Why? Oh, I'm the Lord, the God who took you out of Egypt. Wow. That's pretty wild. And what does Rashi say? I took you out of Egypt. Ani Hashem, Almanat Kain, for this purpose. Why did God take us out of Egypt? God took us out of Egypt to have honest weights. That's why I didn't make this up. That's what it says in the Torah. Avnei Tzedek, Kein Tzedek. I took you out of Egypt. Who cares? What do I mean? I eat matzah because God took us out of Egypt. I have a mezuzah on my house because God passed over our doorpost. Okay. What in the world does having honest weights have to do with leaving Egypt? Because the Egyptians were not, they were dishonest, the way they treated us. So that's what the Torah tells us. And then Rashi's picking up on that. The Chazal are picking up on that. That's because Amalek, they're both attacking the purpose of why we left Egypt. So this is maybe a little bit scary. I don't know what to make of it. I'm the reporter. I'm not the, you know, instigator. But I think this is a very powerful idea. That's what the Torah is saying, that Amalek is, again, we have to look inwards. It doesn't excuse what Amalek did, and there are all kinds of other things, but the Jewish way has always been to say, what can we do better when bad things are happening? I know people maybe don't like that approach so much, and because it's ridiculous to say we know why God does something. We don't know why God does anything. And Chazal had no idea why God did anything. Prophets knew. prophets, prophecy is different. Yeshayahu gets a direct message from God. That's very different. But when Chazal make these comments, Chazal are not saying that that's why Amalek attacked and it's our fault. That's not what they're saying. They're saying there's a parallel between Amalek. Amalek challenged the authority of God. They didn't fear God. It was this God making a new nation. When a person cheats in business, they challenge the gods of running of the world, but righteousness. God said, you believe in God, then we say that how much money we're going to make is determined on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That's a famous Gemara. In Masechet Beitzah. So one who tries to trick God, it's very hard. I mean, it's not simple, but one who tries to trick God, in a sense, is defeating the whole purpose of Egypt. So that, okay, but let's end on happier notes. Maybe just end with one idea, and then I'll do a quick review. We have, there's so many different things in the Parsha. Marriage is in the Parsha, the mitzvah to get married, sort of. It's presented in a very strange way. The Torah presents marriage in a very, very strange way. How did the Torah present marriage? If a man, tikach ish ishiya ubala, if a man takes a woman and he lives with her, and he doesn't like her, so he writes her a sefer kritut, masechet kitin, get married. So marriage right away is in the context of divorce. If he takes a woman and he doesn't like her, he divorces her. But that's not the complete context. That's only half the context. Then the Torah says she's going to go marry somebody else. And the second husband's not going to like her. And he's going to divorce her. And now, my first husband wasn't so bad after all. After I married my second husband, maybe my first husband wasn't bad. So she wants to go back to her first husband. So the Torah says, you cannot go back to her first husband. This is also a toiva. Very interesting. The idea of, I'll try one husband, then I'll go to husband two. I don't like husband two. I'll go back to husband one. So the Torah calls that a toeva. And that's the context of marriage. Very strange. We don't have time to get into it. I haven't gone into it enough exactly. Why does the Torah present marriage in this way? Because marriage is natural. But I will say one idea, a beautiful idea of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. According to the Torah, there's only one way to get married. And how do you get married? We have a wedding ceremony, a chuppah, and the man puts a ring on the finger. Where does that all come from? It's not in the Torah. In the Torah, you get married, you move in together. That's how the Rambam writes. The Rambam writes, until Matan Torah, a man met a woman on the street. That's how he writes. Pago b'shuk, they meet in the street, they meet in the bar, wherever, and they move in together, and they're married. That's it. The Torah came along and said you should do it in a nicer way. But the Torah doesn't tell us that. The Torah here describes, ki yikach ish ishubala. A man takes a woman and he sleeps with her and he lives with her and then he doesn't like her. So the rabbis derive from the word ki yikach. Ki yikach, kicha, kicha, going back to stories and law and narrative. So the rabbis derive that the word kicha, to take, was also used by Abraham. This is a famous Gezeirah Shava, where this is a technique of biblical exegesis, where two words that appear sort of like a little bit out of place, two words appear in two different contexts. So the two words, the fact that the Bible uses the same word, they're highlighting something. They're telegraphing that these two parshiot are connected. It's very, you can make it up. You got to have some kind of source for this. There's you have to have a tradition, but the rabbis identified this kicha with the kicha that Avram Avinu, when he bought the field from Ephron Hachiti, paid 400 shekel, paid a lot of money to bury Sarah. And the same way, kicha, how did he take the field? There it says he paid money. You pay money. So too, when you get married, you can get married by giving your wife something of value. It could be a $10 coin. Whether it can be a $10 bill, that's probably not halachically, because that's only represents money. It's not real money. We're not going to go there. But we do a ring. It can be something of value. Then that's the basis. Kiyika. So the story of Avram Avinu buying the plot for Sarah, his wife, serves as the basis for marriage, for the laws of marriage written 400 years later in the Torah, that we know we can get married by the man giving something of value to his wife. So Rosh Yisrael Hirsch says, what's the connection? It's very nice. Okay, good. So this word here, this word there. So he says, what's marriage about? Marriage is about till death do us part, right? And then, and more some. When a man gets married, he has to be committed to spend $400,000. I mean, 400 shekel, I don't know what it is in modern money. It was a lot of money. It wasn't like $5,000. It was like $100,000, like a ton of money. Like, you know, 5 year salary. I don't know what it was exactly. It was a lot of money. So the number 400 in the Bible, right? Numbers are all symbols, right? What are the 400 numbers in the Bible? 400 years in Egypt, 400 men, Asaph to track Yaakov. When the Torah uses the word number 400, they're using like enormity. Asaph was coming to Yaakov with 400 men. Oh my God. Yaakov was totally afraid. He would have been wiped out had Asaph gone to war. We're going to be in Egypt for 400 years. We're going to be in Egypt. So God was nice. He took us out after 210 years. 400 is like an enormous number in the Bible.
David had 400 men.
I'm sorry?
David had 400 men.
Had 400 men. Okay, I forgot that, but okay. So right. So it probably is not an exact number. It's probably right. Just a number of tremendous size. So when Avraham Avinu pays 400 shekel, so Rav Shish Rav Olaher says there's the legal knowledge. You know, the same word teaches us that one method over there, money works over here. But the idea behind it is that a man has to be, I mean, I guess it applies to the woman too, but the Torah is always written from like the male perspective, that the man has to be totally committed to his wife. And even after she dies, to be willing to spend a ton of money on his wife. He took this sort of very base idea, mundane, and he uplifted it to say that what we learned, the dedication of Avraham had for Sarah, that's how every marriage has to be. Kikach ish isha. Okay. There's a lot more to discuss in the Parsha. It's getting late. So just let me quickly review what we learned. We discussed that law narrative, the Torah, it's not just a series of laws. And in other words, even the laws are not a series of laws. Every law has some idea behind it. And many of the laws in Torah are related or outgrowths of stories in the Torah, whether the simple idea of Yetziat Mitzrayim and how we treat a slave, or the Egla Arufa, the Yom Kippur story, that the Egel, the Cheda Egel, was a passive sin. And the Torah therefore has this parsha of Egla Rufa, where the rabbis were passive and somebody died. That's a terrible sin. That was the sin of the golden calf. It's not just sins of commission, just sins of omission, or you want to say the Yosef story. We have to bring a sin offering with a goat because the brothers dipped his coat in a goat. So stories have impact 100 years later, have it on legal ideas. We just discussed the marriage of Avraham buying a plot for his wife in marriage. And then we discussed how perhaps there's a connection between Parshat Ki Teitzeh and Parshat Vayetzeh. Vayetzeh is the physical formation, the birth of the tribes, going out to war, Yaakov Avinu leaving home for the first time. And in Parshat Ki Teitzeh, we have all the mitzvot, the highest of mitzvot in the Torah, and the Jewish people going out. Ki Teitzeh LaMilchama, and then we talked about Amalek, the notion of war with Amalek. So we have war at the beginning and the end of the Parsha. And Amalek is the rabbis looked for some internal reason how to blame them. What did we do wrong? And this unbelievable, powerful message, because it's in the Torah. It's not Russian. Nobody has to make this up. You just read the Torah. Right before Amalek, the Torah says it's honest weights. So obviously there's some connection between honest weights and Amalek. And in Vayikra, we saw 40 years, you know, we saw the Torah said, Tzedek, 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 honest weights, that because I took you out of Egypt. So, and then we discussed the idea of Ammon and Moab, Miriam, different attitudes towards different enemies or, you know, the Egyptians, we forgive them. They took us in 3 generations. You can't marry them right away. Just like Israel and Germany didn't establish relations in 1948. I think it was only in the 1960s. You need time to heal, but time can heal. That's an inch, whatever. Time can sometimes heal and sometimes time can't heal. Ammon and Moab, that was so not nice what they did. So they can never marry us. We're not going to hurt them, but they can never marry us. Amalek, they were so evil, we got to hurt them. And then we discussed a little bit Miriam and Lashon Hara and Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, the story of how the Torah telegraphs they don't like polygamy. When you have two wives, you're going to have one who hates. And that's what happened to Yaakov. And that's where all the problems began. So that's the Torah. You have to read these laws very carefully. And you always have to read the stories very carefully and see they're intertwined. We just barely scratched the surface on some of these things, but hopefully just a little bit of a taste of the Parsha. So thank you. I'm back on my regular weekly shiur. This was sort of a pinch hit shiur. My regular shiur tomorrow morning on the Siddur at 9:30. Everybody's invited. We're finishing up Ashrei, whatever. So that's like, that's 9:30 tomorrow morning. 11:15, Menachem Liptak kicks off the week. I believe we'll have 12 shiurim next week. Really, I imagine many of you have been to some of the shiurim. I hope you're enjoying them. If not, please let me know. We always like to hear, feedback, both positive and negative, ways to always do better. But I think we have a wonderful series of speakers, and everybody should, participate and invite a friend. Okay. Let me just see if anybody has any questions. I think there are a couple of private questions. Well, then Yaakov was tricked into marrying Leah. Okay, I hear that. But so, no, okay. Yaakov was tricked. The rabbi saw that he tricked his father. So he gets tricked. The rest of his life, Yaakov gets tricked by the brother, by his children. You're right. All these stories are very complex. But on one level, the Torah says he hated Leah. That's what it says. Even though the rabbis interpret he liked Rachel more, that's all irrelevant. And it may even be true. I'm not saying it's not true. It's not relevant. The language of the Torah there and here, it's quite sharp. Why should we connect somebody's writing with privately what Amalek did with honest ways? By creating connection, we infer causality, right? Okay, right. So that's what I'm trying to say. We're not saying that because the Jews were dishonest. That's why they're saying the Holocaust or Amalek happened. We're saying, what lessons can we learn? No, I don't know. It requires more time and more thought, but it's clear. I mean, you see, Rashi says it black and white. The Chumash puts them back together. What my point is that there is a connection. The connection is when you try to outsmart God. That's what Amalek wouldn't accept the authority of God. Amalek was the first nation to show that you can attend. Don't get carried away. God did miracles. Yeah. But let's cool them down. That's how the imagery of Chazal, like in a hot bath, nobody wants to enter. So the first person puts his toe in, he may burn his toe and he may not go in, but then, I'll try. He gave people the idea that you can attack Jews, and everybody else was in fear, right? So he denied that the God's mastery of the world. On a much smaller scale, when we cheat in business, we're doing the same thing. We don't think of it like that because the Talmud says we all cheat in business. That's one of the three areas of sin. We all like to sin in. It's very hard. That's why the first question the Talmud says will be asked is Nasata v'natata b'amunah. Did you have your business dealings conducted faithfully? That's what the Talmud says would be the first question. It's a hard question. That's why there are more mitzvot about money than any other area of the Torah. Meir Tamari points out, one of the leaders in the field of Jewish business ethics, there are about 130 of the 613 mitzvot relate to money. How we make money, how we spend money, how we do with our money, stockish, all the laws. Because that's what we do most of our waking hours. We work and etc. So money is an important, that's what being a true religious Jew means. Kashrut, that's kosher money is more important than kosher food. You can quote me on that if you want. Okay. So whatever. If you disagree, I'm happy to hear any disagreements. I'm like, be sure to afford more protection to the weak. That's an interesting idea. Somebody writing me privately. That we can learn from Amalek to give more protection to weak. I actually like that very much. I didn't think of that. The same way Egypt is to remind us to be nice to the stranger, right? Because we not to enslave others. So Amalek attacked the weak. So what we have to learn from Amalek is we should not attack the weak. And there's a weak. Very nice idea. Okay. Okay, I think that's it. Hopefully we'll see you tomorrow or next week. And like I say, please invite a friend. That's word of mouth is our best form of advertisement. And please invite. And if you don't have any friends, go to shul and make some. And go over to the briefing you see on the street, hello, and just introduce, give them a tour motion flyer. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful
day. Thank
you. We look forward to seeing you soon.
Yes, thank you.
All the best. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
See everybody.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.